Hello and welcome to the Rogers Brief for February 2nd, 2024. I'm Adam Rogers. Thank you for watching and thank you for listening. Regular watchers and listeners of the Rogers Brief will know that I usually focus on a number of stories, you know, five, six, seven, either cases or news stories, and analyze those. This week's going to be a little different because I'm going to focus on one story, which is the release of the Desmond Inquiry report. This was a long time coming. It's been over 7 years since the tragic deaths of Aaliyah, Shayna, Brenda Desmond, and Lionel Desmond, the late Corporal Lionel Desmond, which led to the calling for an inquiry. Eventually, an inquiry was called over the objections of the provincial and federal governments, but an inquiry did take place. And it took a long time to get to this point where the final report was released, but it was released on Wednesday. And I represented Cassandra Desmond, who was the sister of the late Corporal Desmond, and she was appointed as his personal representative. And it's done under the legislation called the Fatality Investigations Act in Nova Scotia, and what something of a, like a coroner's inquest. So the chief medical examiner, Dr. Matthew Bowes, through the legislation, can, force an inquiry to happen. This inquiry happened above the wishes of the federal and provincial governments, both of whom rejected calls for an inquiry initially. And so it took a long time to get started, took a long time to get going, but we're finally here at the report stage. So I want to talk about that report. I want to talk about the contents of the report, some of what I see as the shortcomings, and then the reactions from the families and from the federal and provincial governments. I'll talk first about the release itself. So this was took place on Wednesday in Port Hawkesbury at the Justice Center. And draw some distinctions between the release of the Desmond Inquiry report and the Mass Casualty Commission report, which took place last year in Truro at a big convention room. The Prime Minister was there, Minister of Public Safety, the Premier of Nova Scotia, lots of politicians were there. Lots of members of the RCMP, lots of big crowds of people. The Desmond Inquiry release was different. There was there were no politicians there. The only sort of other distinguished guest, although he wasn't introduced, he was there, was Chief Judge of the Provincial Court, Perry Borden, Honorable Judge Perry Borden. So, and it was a pretty brief presentation. Judge Paul Scoville, who's a retired judge out of Amherst, well-regarded judge who wrote the report, he made some brief opening remarks and then read into the record his 25 recommendations, and then that was it. It was over, and then it was just a matter of a media scrum, and then everybody went about their business. So it was a short release event. And one person who was not there was Judge Warren Zimmer. Judge Zimmer, who led the inquiry, who was there for all of the hearing days, who developed the structure of the inquiry, who examined many different expert reports, determined which experts should be called, organized all of the witnesses, took input from counsel, and was there day to day, was not present. So as people may recall, last summer, Judge Zimmer was removed from the inquiry. Very unusual situation. Something that would not have been anticipated when the inquiry was called 6 years ago, which is that Judge Zimmer had reached the mandatory retirement age of 75. Judges have to retire at age 75. Well, he was extended by executive order by the provincial government. He was extended for a couple of 3 month stints, but then they got to a point where they just said no more. last summer. And Judge Zimmer was, you know, he said his piece. He was very close to finishing the report that, you know, he listed off the number of documents, which compared, it was very comparable to the Mass Casualty Commission report. And the Mass Casualty Commission had three commissioners. They had, like, you know, 30 staff, a whole bunch of lawyers, a law firm working for them in the background, all compiling the information, writing parts of the report, helping with the report. And Judge Zimmer was doing it on his own. And so nobody from the families, nobody from none of the parties in the inquiry were pressing the government to replace him. But he was replaced. They refused to continue to extend his term, which didn't make any sense to us at the time, certainly. And it's unusual. So there is just on that point for a second, there is a provision in the criminal code for replacing judges who become incapacitated or die during the course of a trial. And the rule is basically this, like if you're in the middle of hearing evidence, then you have to start over. If you're at the end of, if the judge has heard all of the evidence but has not rendered a decision, well, then you have to start over again. Now, in some cases, if there's not a, if credibility is not really an issue, then you can, the new judge is permitted to take a transcript of the original hearing, read through it by agreement of the parties, and then, you know, make a decision from there. That's rare. Usually you would see a judge starting over. In civil court matters, which may be more comparable, wouldn't be uncommon. Like I say, particularly where credibility is not an issue. If the judge has already made a determination of guilt, then, you know, a new judge can come in to do sentencing. Or a jury trial where the jury is the entity that makes the decision, well, you can replace a judge. So it's possible, but it's very rare. And it's very rare to do it in circumstances like this where a judge is still available and still there to do the work. And very unfortunate. So what I would say, I'd characterize the report, and this is in no way disrespectful to Judge Scoville. I thought it did very well under the circumstances, as well as could be expected coming in after the fact. It's like writing an exam without having gone to class, right? You can still do well, but you're not going to have the same depth of understanding as somebody who's been there throughout. And Judge Zimmer, who's, you know, has a very good reputation as a lawyer. He was one of the top defense lawyers in the province before he was named to the bench, had a good reputation as a judge, had been thinking about this and nothing but this for 5 years, 6 years. You know, every day he was listening to the evidence and, you know, reflecting upon it that night and then coming back the next day to hear more evidence and studying the issues, you know, for day after day. So that, I would say it's a functional report. It doesn't make any mistakes, any major mistakes, certainly. But it doesn't have the same kind of bite that I would have expected from Judge Zimmer. And it certainly doesn't have the same kind of flavor that you would expect from somebody that would have the depth of understanding of the issues and, you know, the time to reflect on everything that he's heard that Judge Zimmer had. So I would be very curious. Now, when Judge Scoville was appointed, one of the things I recommended to him when he gave an opportunity for us to speak was that if he had any, because Judge Zimmer at that point had indicated that he had started writing the report. I said, well, if you disagree with anything Judge Zimmer has concluded or any preliminary conclusions, you should say so. Well, there's nothing to indicate that in there. He did thank Judge Zimmer. Which is more than I could say for the province of Nova Scotia. I'll come to the report in a minute. I was just looking at the reaction, the statement issued under the name of the Justice Minister thanked Judge Scoville, mentioned Judge Scoville three times, thanked him for his diligence and timely work, which Anyway, I thought it was a little petty for them not to mention Judge Zimmer and all the work that Judge Zimmer put into it. It seemed to me a little bit of a power dynamic. Judge Zimmer was, you know, it was a judicial inquiry, so Judge Zimmer controls when the release of the report takes place. The province was had suggested deadlines or announced deadlines without Judge Zimmer's you know, cooperation or input. So it certainly seemed like there was something going on in the background there. But what it is, it's robbed us in a sense of some of, you know, what would have been insightful comments, commentary, and a report from, you know, one of the top legal minds in Nova Scotia. But we do have the report, so I want to go through some of the recommendations and some of the themes in there. So there was, I guess I'd say, four main themes. There was one talked about the transition from the military to civilian life. And in the inquiry, we heard there was lots of gaps in this. There was 6 months between when there was Corporal Desmond wasn't given a caseworker for 6 months. And so, well, I guess there's two sides to the transition out of military life. One is having your health records transferred from the military to the civilian life. So somebody with a complex health history that's in the military, you know, may have neuropsychological assessments done, may have all kinds of counseling records. None of that gets transferred to the province. There's no mechanism for that to take place. It's not provided to the military veteran when they leave. It's just kept by the federal system. And so a military person who goes back home and re-enter civilian life is a stranger to the health system, even though they might have an extensive history and potentially a complex history, as the case was with Lionel Desmond. So that transition is important. The second one is the sort of the social transition. You're going back to a family that loves you, but is, you know, you're a stranger to them in certain ways because of the experience and the trauma you've been through, potentially as a soldier going into military action, and to your community as well. You know, they knew you in Corporal Desmond's case as a, you know, happy-go-lucky, outgoing, you know, very positive person. He comes back withdrawn, quiet, with you know, not wishing to engage in social activities and such. So, you know, trying to understand that dynamic and to help with that transition, that's something that could emerge from this. The second theme would be intimate partner violence. Thought this is going to be a difficult thing for the report to grasp because it's not a simple matter. I'm going to come back to why, but, you know, of course it's domestic violence when you take a gun and shoot your wife and your child and your mother, but it's not a simple matter because of Corporal Desmond's post-traumatic stress disorder and some of the complications of that. So there are good recommendations in there for police officers to be aware and to, you know, use a certain checklist on intimate partner situations or potential situations to go through that and really examine if there's more intervention that might be needed. This is also, and so one of the other things Judge Zimmer was trying to do, and one of the reasons that his report was taking some time, was that he was seeking some more answers from the provincial government about what they were going to do in reaction to the Mass Casualty Commission recommendations, which were dramatic in the field of intimate partner violence. Among the recommendations were to stop the sort of pro-prosecution stance, the automatic pro-prosecution stance of, you know, the police and the crowns, and think about domestic violence and intimate partner violence in a different way, I guess. Because what happens if you prosecute everybody that reports, you know, you prosecute anybody who's reported to have, you know, be involved in a domestic violence situation, Many people don't want their spouse to be in trouble in facing criminal charges. They just want them gone for the night or a couple of nights or to get some help or something else. They don't want the complications of the police involvement and everything else. But if so, what happens is they don't call. So that's a problem. So that's not really confronted in this report, but that's something that'll have to interact with the Mass Casualty Commission recommendations. The third one is health services for African Nova Scotian communities. Recognition through the inquiry that it's more difficult for African Nova Scotian individuals to seek out health services because the staffing, the people in the hospital, the institution itself is not reflective of the diversity in our society, and so African Nova Scotians don't often see themselves in the system, and so they're not as comfortable accessing services. Now, despite that, Corporal Desmond did time and time again seek out help. He knew he wasn't right. His head wasn't good. He had suffered three concussions, the post-traumatic stress disorder from the trauma from the war in Afghanistan, that firefights that he faced every day for 7 months while he was there. So he overcame those barriers, but they nevertheless exist. And so recommendations to increase staffing levels of African Nova Scotians in the health system, I think, is a very good one. Fourth one is the firearm systems. And some real gaps. So firearms is a federal responsibility, but it is administered by provincial systems. And so this leads to situations where, for example, Corporal Desmond had his firearms taken away from him in New Brunswick in Gagetown, but then he was able to come into Nova Scotia, and there's no record of that in the provincial system here. So some integration there. And also he was in the military because they knew him well, and he had been seeking out treatment. He was under conditions there not to have firearms, but then when he emerges back into civilian life, he was able to. So those systems weren't aligned either. So to fix those the holes in that system. There's a few others as well, but so we see a lot of attention in the media. Whenever they talk about firearms, they always talk about certain types of firearms. But what gets less attention, but what could have much more of an impact, are things like this. If somebody's in one province and they're not allowed to have firearms, then they shouldn't be able to have firearms in another province either. So fixing those gaps is certainly something that is important. The last recommendation is to have an implementation committee oversee the recommendations. And this is, I think, going to be something that needs to change. The implementation committee recommended by Judge Scoville was to have one that was made up of senior provincial bureaucrats. I think that is a recipe for nothing much happening with, meetings behind closed doors of bureaucrats. How's anybody going to know what is taking place? No reporting conditions or anything like that. I think the family needs to be involved. I think it needs to be public. Something needs to change there. We've seen in the Mass Casualty Commission, it's been almost a year, they've had an implementation committee. Nobody really knows what they're doing or what steps they've taken, and it's all done in secret and by consensus. So if there's any dissension or problems in the committee, we're not even going to learn about them. So I think there needs to be some adjustments there. All right, so what's not in the report? Part of this, like I say, is a function. There's two things. One is a function of Judge Zimmer not having written the report. So I think Veterans Affairs Canada got off very easy in this report. We learned during the inquiry they have like a Kafka-esque bureaucracy. Like at one point, Corporal Desmond was assigned a care coordinator. Somebody that was going to look after, all right, making sure he got the right appointments with the right healthcare providers. She was supposed to take, she had to take this online course to learn how to use the database system for Veterans Affairs. And it took like 2 or 3 months, and she wasn't able to, the technology wasn't working. It just wasn't coming together. And she's like, well, I can start the work now. And they're like, no, you got to do this first. And then finally, it just got to the point that it's like, oh no, go ahead and meet with them and start working. And this Helen Ludi, who It's from Sydney. She said she'd never, you know, she does this kind of work. She said she'd never seen anything like it before in her life and has not worked with Veterans Affairs since. So that was one thing. The second thing was, and this is, I think, the most important thing that was missing from the report, is a study on post-traumatic stress disorder. Central to the situation, the reason, I think it needed more attention. What happened? What actually happened the day of the killings? Well, Corporal Desmond had gone to many different healthcare providers, different counselors, and they all identified that he had post-traumatic stress disorder. They also identified that he had a special sort of subset of that, which involved dissociative episodes. He was, you know, what that means is that he wasn't present in the moment. He was back in Afghanistan. He was, you know, in his mind, that's where he was. And this happened around people, you know, around Shayna, around, Sheldon Borden had observed it. Others had observed it. It had been observed in a clinical setting as well, that he had these episodes. And it seemed like that was what was happening when the killings took place. I mean, everything that he was doing, you know, in the days leading up to January 3rd, he was future oriented. He was getting gym memberships. He was looking into the future. He was opening bank accounts. He was making plans for the next weekend. He had done all these things. You know, he was looking good. He kept himself up. He wasn't, you know, the signs of suicide in a way, or potential suicide, you know, people let themselves go. They're, you know, all these things are different. He wasn't like that. And even to the detail of the gun that he bought at Leaves and Limbs, it wasn't just, all right, give me a gun, I have something to do. He bought a gun that was set for long-term use. It was a smart purchase. He bought a used gun. He didn't just, all right, give me that one off the rack. He bought good ammunition. He didn't buy just the cheapest ammunition. All of these things looked like a long-term purchase. And then, and he's in camouflage, crawling, you know, walking through the woods to his home. So a lot of the things added up to the fact that he was probably having a dissociative episode. And we heard expert evidence as well that that was an area that was, you know, it's not unusual for soldiers, people with PTSD. And it's an area that needs further study. So I thought a recommendation of that effect would have gone a long way to fostering that kind of effort, but that didn't take place. So that's something I think that needs to come in. So the responses. I already talked about the provincial government response. The families, they're fairly happy with it, with the report. Although I thought Sheldon Borden made some good points. So the racial side of this, I'll talk about that for a moment. You know, compare this to the Mass Casualty Commission, where whatever, $30, $40, $50 million spent and a huge effort made. Not the case here. Here, you know, resisted the inquiry throughout and replaced the judge to undermine the whole thing. And, you know, what's going to happen? Who knows? It makes you wonder. Sheldon made the point, too, like there, you know, Ricky and Thelma Borden have to still live in their house. They can't sell it, can't burn it down, because what are you going to do then? You're giving up your house and you're not going to get insurance if you burn it down yourself. He made the comparison to the Sydney River McDonald's, which I thought was it's different, right? The Sydney River McDonald's, after the murders there, it's a commercial enterprise. Anybody's going to show up. You know, maybe that's just a business decision to tear that place down, which is different, but not completely different. Federal government response. Federal government Minister Taylor Pettipaw basically said, you know, we've been following the inquiry, we've been making all kinds of changes, and things are better. Don't believe it for a second. I think, again, Judge Zimmer's comments would have been instructive here, but he would have had a lot to say, I think, about Veterans Affairs. in their closing submissions, the federal government said, no, everything's good. We're making these changes. So we've hired some more workers. Everything's going smooth. That's not what I hear from veterans. So I'd be interested to see how that dynamic plays out as well. I don't have a lot of faith in it, right? Because, again, both the federal and provincial governments resisted the call for the inquiry. The provincial government. So, yeah, I wanted to mention this when talking about replacing the judge. None of the parties involved wanted the judge replaced. Nobody asked for this. Nobody said, nobody thought it was taking way too long for him to issue his report. But who replaced him? The provincial government. Well, during the inquiry, the provincial government lawyers, and there were two of them there the whole time, I can count on one hand how many times they get up to ask questions of any witness. Like, they didn't say anything. And then at the end of the inquiry, they just said, yeah, okay, everything's fine. We've made some changes. And, if we haven't made the changes already, we're already working on it and all's fine. So it just seemed like they were taking the position that they didn't need to do anything new or different and everything was good. So it doesn't encourage, it doesn't foster faith that they're going to, put their shoulder to the wheel and make all kinds of new changes going in the future. So we'll see. But it was, so I guess to summarize, like I say, it's a lot there to digest. I would encourage people to read it. It's on the desmondinquiry.ca website. And you can look through the recommendations. I think there's good recommendations. It's a solid report. Kudos to Judge Scoville for having done so under very difficult circumstances, making himself available and doing a good job of it from what he could do. Nobody's denying that. But I think we were shortchanged by the change in the judge at the late stage. Incredibly unusual situation. And we'll be keeping a close eye on things to see if this implementation committee has any teeth, if they actually do the work that is they're being tasked with doing, and we'll keep an eye on all of that. So I wanted to do a deep dive into the Desmond Inquiry report this week. It was something that I worked on very, very hard for a long time. I've been involved in this since soon after the tragic events. Sad day for many, many people, and that's resonated, and it's certainly not not gone away, and it never will probably for many people. But good to see this report. Hopefully it'll be the good recommendations from there will be implemented, and we'll see some changes for military veterans and their families. You know, you think of this in terms of military recruiting, Canada is going to have a military that's going to be involved in actions around the world. How are we going to do that if we don't know how to treat our veterans when we get home? How are we going to recruit new members of the military if, they know on the back end that they're going to be facing the same kind of risks that Corporal Desmond faced? None of his colleagues, none of the people in his company were killed in Afghanistan. 8 committed suicide upon return. So that tells you what kind of struggles they were facing, what kind of difficulties. So lots of work left to do, and lots of advocating left to do. Big kudos to Cassandra and Chantel Desmond, the whole Desmond and Borden families, for putting the work in to make sure this inquiry happened, to keep it on track, and the bravery throughout, courage in facing big institutions on the biggest stage, and being persistent at it. So that was a lot of good things that came out of this, and hopefully there'll be more to come. So all right, thank you. That's everything I wanted to say about the Desmond Inquiry. I'm going to be saying probably more on the Sunday night show with Paul Palango and Jordan Bonaparte. You can watch that on YouTube live on Sunday night on the nighttime podcast channel, starting at 9:15. I'll talk about that and some other stories, no doubt, as well, and be back next week with another Rogers Brief. So thank you again for watching. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.